And we have an informational meeting today. A number of different presenters. Let me call Mike Graney, the director of the Oregon Department of Energy, first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm happy to be here today, and I wanted to take a few minutes to give you an overview of biofuels and how it fits into the energy picture in Oregon generally, both its current use and its potential use play a much greater role, and some of the benefits that would present, both economic and in terms of our energy supply situation and environmental benefits as well. Perhaps by way of background, bioenergy generally means energy that comes from forests and farm waste or from crops that are designed for energy use. And it can be directly used for heating, for burning for electricity, and for biofuels in particular means as a vehicle fuel, primarily biodiesel or ethanol. And biofuels themselves are part of what we call alternative fuels, and I'll talk briefly about what we mean by alternative fuels. Alternative fuels are substitutes or replacements for petroleum, or can be used in combination with petroleum to make the fuel cleaner and in some cases more efficient and simply to increase the supply. That's very important because our energy bills as Oregonians exceed $7 billion a year, and 40% of that is for fuel, for transportation fuel. Petroleum use in Oregon has tripled in the last 40 years. It plays a major role in the costs of energy. So alternative fuels, including the biofuels, are important because they can help reduce some of our reliance on imported petroleum. They can help diversify our fuels, and that in turn can help reduce the pressure on costs. They have environmental benefits. In general, they're cleaner burning than fossil fuels, particularly cleaner burning than petroleum. Biofuels also can help the local economy if they're grown from, if they develop from forest and farm products or forest and farm waste, and have particular benefits for rural Oregon in that regard. There's already in Oregon a significant use of bioenergy. 12% of our total energy consumption is from bioenergy. Now, that's primarily wood products and wood waste for generation of electricity. But there is some biofuels in that figure as well. And we have state incentives, principally the state energy tax credits, both the residential tax credit and the business energy tax credit, and our energy loan program, which provides low-interest loans to fund renewable resources and alternative fuels that these that the production of these fuels qualify for. And to give you an example, again, looking at bioenergy, the big picture, some 300 projects worth over $90 million have used the business energy tax credit in the last 20 years for bioenergy. Five of them just in the last year, in excess of $6 million of investments, and we've had $50 million in energy loans for bioenergy projects. And again, most of those are for direct use or electricity, burning of bioenergy fuels for electricity. Going to biofuels for vehicles is a little more difficult and has been both technically and cost-wise, so that's why we've seen less use of biofuels up till now. But we are at, I think, at a juncture, and you'll hear more from the other witnesses, where biofuels can play an increasing role in Oregon.
Why is that? Why has it been difficult for this state in transportation or automotive?
Well, Mr. Chairman, one reason is that it's an added process, just chemically, to create fuel, liquid fuel from forests and farm products rather than simply burning directly. In addition, in the Midwest, where there is significant use of ethanol, it relies heavily on corn that is grown that meets different climate advantages than the crops we have out here. But again, that's starting to change in terms of the options we have for crops and the new technologies. But those are some of the reasons.
Thank you.
Let me just mention briefly what both biodiesel and ethanol are. Biodiesel is an organic compound either from waste grease products or mustard seed, canola, other seeds. It's biodegradable. It's non-toxic. They can be used in combinations anywhere from 2% with regular diesel to 100% pure biodiesel. Up to about 20% of biodiesel combined with traditional diesel, you don't have to make engine adjustments. Beyond that, you need to make adjustments, changes in the engine so it can run on richer fuels. For ethanol is produced currently primarily from corn and from starches, although it could also be produced from other cellulose, including wood and wood waste as well. Up to 10% doesn't require engine modification, and in fact, in Portland area and other parts of the state, it's often mixed with gasoline for air quality reasons in the winter, what's called the oxygenate mandate or requirement. Much beyond 10% may require some engine adjustments. There are cars that will run up to what's called E85 or 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline, and I'll talk a little more about those in a moment. Currently in Oregon, ethanol constitutes about 4% by volume of our gasoline use, biodiesel less than 1%. The ethanol constitutes about 60 million gallons a year that we're using, and all of that is produced from the Midwest and brought in from the Midwest. We have currently no production in Oregon, but we have three sites under active consideration, one in Clatskanie on the Columbia River, one at Boardman, and one in Ontario. And our hope is that between those three, if they all go forward, we could be producing in Oregon upwards of 100 million gallons a year, or nearly double the consumption that we currently use in Oregon. And the Department of Administrative Services is been an enthusiastic supporter of alternative fuels. They have 67 flexible fuel vehicles that can run on ethanol and high ethanol fuels, and they're in the process of setting up an E85 fueling station for state vehicles that can run on this fuel. With biodiesel, there's a production facility we hope that will be operating soon in Portland and the North Portland area. Currently, about 700,000 gallons of biodiesel are sold in Oregon, and almost a third of that, 200,000 gallons, are used by the Department of Administrative Services for state fleets. There's also a retail station being established in Medford, a private one that would be open for retail. They hope to sell upwards of 50,000 gallons a year. Sequential Biofuels, which is perhaps the most active company in biodiesel in Oregon, has been active and has recently established a mobile delivery system of biodiesel.
What was the name of that company?
Sequential Biofuels. And they operate out of both Portland and Eugene, I believe. We mentioned two other alternative fuels that aren't strictly biofuels but do play an important role. One is compressed natural gas. Natural gas is normally in a gaseous state, and by compressing it under high pressure, while it's still gaseous, it can be used as a fuel in cars and in buses and other vehicles. The buses in Salem, the ones that are red colored and have clean machine sign on them. And that's about 20% of the fleet here. Those are CNG buses. And the Salem Transit System is in the process of converting all of its buses, all 60 buses, to CNG vehicles. They have no exhaust when you get behind them. Much cleaner burning than traditional fuels, and they've taken advantage of the state incentive programs that are for alternative fuels to do those conversions and to establish a fueling station at the transit center. CNG particularly works well where you have buses or delivery trucks that come back to a central fueling station each night that you don't have to worry about setting up infrastructure throughout the state, like individual gasoline stations. Again, the Department of Administrative Services has been very supportive. They have about 150 CNG cars and have established fueling pumps at the motor pools in Portland, Salem, and Eugene, are in the process of setting one up in Medford as well. One other category of vehicles I should mention is the hybrids. These are the hybrid electric gasoline vehicles that can use existing gasoline engines, use existing gasoline stations, but can operate much more efficiently, get upwards of 45 miles to the gallon on them. We've had, DAS has over 100 hybrid cars. We've had over 4,000 individuals have purchased these cars in Oregon and taken with the assistance of the residential energy tax credit. So it's another important part of our efforts to diversify our energy resources in the transportation sector. Some of the materials I've provided for you on the right side of the packet. There's more background on alternative fuel activity in Oregon. Also, I want to mention the Oregon Renewable Energy Action Plan. You have the second draft, which is the latest draft of that plan that we've been working on. Over the last year, we've had numerous public meetings. It focuses on different ways to encourage renewable energy and has a number of pages on biofuels in particular, biodiesel and ethanol, and other energy uses for forests and farm waste and farm products. That plan calls for 15 million of gallons of biodiesel eventually produced annually from Oregon crops and 100 million gallons of ethanol annually, with proposals and recommendations on how to get there, actions agencies can take, actions to work with the private sector, and some legislation. There's also three bills that I've included in your materials that come out of the Renewable Energy Action Plan that would, I think, encourage biofuels as well as other renewable energy. And that one is in the, actually, from the left side. I apologize for the confusion there. So there's a heading that says Renewable Energy Bills, and that's three bills that would, first one would authorize state agencies to develop renewable energy, for example, either on state land, state forests, also use of solar energy, for example, in state buildings. The second bill would make technical changes in our energy loan program that would make it easier to fund more renewable energy projects. And the third one would expand the exemption that there is in our siting process for ethanol production facilities that meet certain criteria that reduce environmental impacts, and expand that to include biodiesel facilities that meet the same criteria that already have land use approval and that either barge or rail most of their product in and out of the facility to minimize environmental impacts. I'll just mention also that we have worked closely with Department of Ag, Department of Forestry, and Economic Development Department, and you'll hear from two of those later today, because of the importance of the agricultural community and the forest products industry in these fields and the economic development impacts this can have. We estimate that if $300 million of of investments were made in renewable resources, which we think is a realistic target. That could create nearly 4,000 new jobs, primarily in rural Oregon. And it would be a benefit to Oregonians. It would keep more of our energy dollars in-state, directly benefiting our local economy. We conclude by simply mentioning that in your packets, too, I've given you some additional information on other energy issues in case we don't have the opportunity to visit on these anytime soon. I wanted to give you an update of power plant siting. Since the 2001 energy crisis, our power supply situation has stabilized substantially. We have over 2,200 megawatts operating of power plants. That's 11 different power plants. Our siting council, it's a citizens panel that makes the actual decisions for energy power plants, has approved 16 other power plants with over 3,400 megawatts. Most of these are natural gas, but some are wind and cogeneration. We have the largest wind project in the country, the State Line Wind Project on the Oregon-Washington border. It's over 300 megawatts that's operating. And there's additional information on other energy conservation and renewable resource activity we're doing, as well as our work on cleaning up radioactive waste, both in-state and representing Oregon on the Hanford nuclear site in the state of Washington, the issues that affect Oregon there. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions now or after the other panelists are completed.
Thank you, Mike. So are you planning on staying around for a while?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Questions from the committee?
Okay.
Representative Lynn.
Concerning the hybrid cars, and how many do we have in our state here? I read it.
4,000?
Yes, we have 4,000 hybrid vehicles.
Okay.
They're taking advantage of the state incentives.
Okay, and could we move more aggressively more hybrid cars for the public use? And what's hampering it because of the cost of hybrid cars higher?
The upfront cost is higher. I don't think the maintenance cost is any higher. The information we have doesn't indicate that. There has been difficulty in getting enough vehicles as initial production startups. I think the demand far exceeded the expectations. That has been dealt with to a large degree. It's much easier to order hybrid vehicles now. I think the incentive that we have is a reasonable incentive. It's a $1,500 maximum for individuals on to help defray what's anywhere between a $3,000 and $5,000 incremental cost over a comparable gasoline vehicle. I think there needs to be, you know, it's always a guess as to what's a reasonable incentive, but you don't want to, I think, make it so generous that the primary motivation is the economic incentive and the state is overpaying, in effect, for the desired activity. And this way the individual makes some investment, but also gets help in defraying the cost of that. And gets the added benefit of substantially reduced fuel costs.
Representative Garrard.
Mike, where does the Siting Council get its authority?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, Siting Council gets its authority from state law, which you write. So it's current law. These are 7 volunteer citizens. It's comparable to other commissions, except their authority is limited to energy facility siting and regulation of energy facilities. There's large energy facilities, so it's principally power plants, certain transmission lines, certain pipelines.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Hello?
Mike's well aware of a controversy in my district involving siting a power plant on exclusive farm use land.
Mm-hmm.
It's not gone over very well with some of the farmers involved. So I was just curious. The Siting Council is somewhat of a mystery to some of us, so I appreciate you telling me.
Thank you.
You mentioned toward the end of your testimony, Mike, about the fact that you were involved in, I believe, in ethanol production in farm and forest. Could you expand a little on that? You mentioned three sites that you're talking about to produce ethanol.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We've been contacted by developers for three different sites. One's at Clatskanie on the Columbia River, northwest of Portland. One would be at Boardman, quite a bit smaller facility, and then one in Ontario. We'd like to see all three of them go forward. One at Clatskanie was large enough to be considered an energy facility and qualified for the exemption that's under current law because it meets the criteria for minimizing environmental impact. All three of those facilities would also qualify for both the state tax credit and our energy loan program if they want to proceed on financing assistance.
So the state would actually be involved in helping them get set up and started. Are there federal funds as well?
What's that?
Are there federal funds as well to help?
We're not aware of any direct grants. We've looked at that. Those are things that sometimes come and go. It's something that we're continuing to look at for the developers.
What's the size of the state trust fund right now?
Well, the tax credits, there's a $10 million per project limit. The cost of these facilities, especially the one at Clatskanie, would well exceed that, but the limit is $10 million per project, and it's a 35% tax credit, so that means a $3.5 million reduction of taxes over 5 years. With our energy loan program, that's funded by bonds that we issue, and then the loans repay the bonds, so we would issue the bonds as needed. We've gone as high as $20 million in loans for a few projects. It's likely that the one in Boardman would be less than that. The one at Clatskanie would be more than that. We probably need other sources of financing, which they're working on. The one in Ontario, I'm not entirely sure what their financial arrangement would be.
Okay. One other question I had, and that is there are agencies that have credits for emissions. Is that all under DOE, or would it be more under DEQ?
No, it would be under DEQ to the extent there's emissions issues there.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call on Glenn Montgomery. State your name and tell us a little bit about your organization, Mike. Glenn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Sustainable Business Liaison for Oregon Economic and Community Development.
Thanks.
Mr. Graney did a fine job of providing a foundation from which I will try to build upon. Without spewing mind-numbing statistics on numbers and data from research and analysis, I'd like to share with you in general what Economic and Community Development has been doing as an agency, with whom we've been collaborating, and what type of initiatives we've been involved in as they relate to the biofuels industry. We have been engaged in a number of initiatives to promote sustainable development in Oregon. And I've broken these out three ways in terms of research and economic analysis, public policy, education and advocacy, and then market or business development. So within our research component, we have been working with the Oregon Business Alliance and the Oregon Environmental Council and involving public agencies and private stakeholders, non-governmental organizations, in a multi-stakeholder effort to help identify economic development opportunities in Oregon as they relate to biofuels. And that's been specifically targeted towards power generation and transportation. Biofuels happens to be one component of the overall study that we are currently undertaking. And with respect to biofuels, we've found some very compelling information that is, in my view, a significant opportunity for not only Oregon agriculture, but also other sectors, including our construction, transportation, manufacturing, and service industries. Mike had mentioned briefly an estimate in terms of investment dollars and what kind of return we might see in jobs. That came from an Energy Trust report from 2003. To give you a practical example of one of the companies that Mike had referred to that's looking at an ethanol plant, and this company has been working toward this effort for a number of years now, Cascade Grains. They hope to create, with their plant, 100 million gallon per year ethanol plant, roughly 90 jobs, 60 of which would pertain to the plant operations, and another 30 that are related to the process of producing the ethanol. Those jobs would be family wage jobs, averaging $20 plus an hour. So we're talking about some significant opportunities for Oregonians. And they will also provide some opportunities for our supporting industries. As you know, we look at industry clusters and the ripple effect that this can have on the overall economy. With respect to biodiesel, again, Mike mentioned there are a number of projects underway. Sequential Biofuels is very close. They've lined up their financing. It's an exciting opportunity to get a biodiesel plant here on the ground in Oregon, because at this point in time, we are importing that fuel. And that has, again, some tremendous opportunities for our farmers in terms of rotation crops and getting a value add from those crops. It'll increase their flexibility in the marketplace. From a public policy, education, and advocacy standpoint, we've been working with the Department of Energy, as Mike mentioned, on the Renewable Energy Action Plan. A number of agencies have collaborated on that. One of those components being biofuels, in that it will strengthen our agricultural economy, generating jobs in energy, in construction, manufacturing, transportation, and it will also help us manage our stewardship of the natural resources that we have here in Oregon, which can improve the quality of life of all of us in this state. We've been sharing information among the agencies, energy, agriculture, forestry, to identify where technology improvements might play a role in spurring this market, where case studies have proven success or failure, where we can learn from those, grant opportunities, public policy initiatives. So there's a lot of information that's being passed between agencies to continue to further our efforts. OECDD is administering an EPA grant that we were awarded last year, and that grant is meant to help promote, to educate the various stakeholders who can benefit from biodiesel initiatives. So we are the administrators of that. We're working with the Oregon Environmental Council and others who are managing the on-the-ground activities for that particular initiative. Most recently, I was in Bend to celebrate the signing of the Crop Initiative, which is an Oregon Solutions project. Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council has been working on that. And that is truly an example of a diverse, very diverse set of stakeholders from all walks of life who have come together and agreed and put together a declaration of cooperation on how they're going to be using biomass and trying to provide a steady supply of that in order to generate power and to create fuels. And that's going to help us in our forestry sector, agricultural sector, reducing wildlife fire risks, promoting new jobs, creating a greater independence for our energy usage in Oregon. And then in general, along the lines of business development, a number of the businesses that are trying to get these efforts off the ground, as you know, economic and community development is there as an advocate. We have business development officers who are engaged in those activities. We're working to help them secure financing. We're helping them with the siting of facilities, with permit processing, trying to expedite those where we can, and ultimately providing whatever resources that we can to make sure that we're helping move those projects forward. So, in brief, that is what I would like to share with you in terms of our involvement in economic and community development. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Representative Jensen.
Could you help me a little bit? What advantages does petrodiesel have over, or what economic advantages does petrodiesel have over biodiesel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, if I understand the question correctly, you're asking about petrol-based fuels versus bio-based, and what are the economic benefits of our fossil fuel? Well, currently, if you're looking at petroleum-based fuels, specifically diesel versus biodiesel, there is about a 25-cent difference, and that would be an increase in cost for the biodiesel as opposed to petroleum diesel. So there is a slight premium that is being paid, and that's covering the added cost associated with processing biodiesel. There is a federal tax incentive that has gone into effect, I believe, January of this year, although they're still working out the rules that will probably not be posted until July, that are going to be providing a 1 cent per percent for 1% of biodiesel tax credit. So if you're producing B20, a 20% biodiesel mix, you have a 20-cent tax credit. That, in turn, is going to provide a downward pressure on pricing. It's not going to, those that are producing and getting the tax credit will keep some of it, but because of competitive pressures, pricing will go down. But in short, that is the ultimate economic benefit to the consumer for petroleum-based product.
What, if I may? Biodiesel, I understand as low as a 10% mix, has a dramatic increase or dramatic improvement in air quality. Is that correct?
Representative Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but a B10 blend will reduce various particulate matters, greenhouse gas emissions, and such. What you are defining as dramatic, it is greatly increased as the percentage goes up. And one of my colleagues, Justin Kluwer, may have those answers. I'm not sure. Brent Searle may as well. But there is, if I remember correctly, a B20 blend reduces greenhouse gas emissions by roughly 25%, whereas a B100, a complete biodiesel, 100% biodiesel, 78%. It will decrease all of the particulate matters, greenhouse gases, and emissions with a slight increase in what's called nitrous oxides.
If I follow on the economic, what is the impact on any significant any impact on the engines, longer life, shorter life? What information, if any, do you have on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, biodiesel is actually a cleaner burning fuel and has a positive impact on the overall wear and tear of an engine. It has, for example, in July of 2006 or June of 2006, we will have a law passed that requires what's called ultra-low sulfur diesel in on-road vehicles. The problem with ultra-low sulfur diesel is it doesn't have the lubricity, which would increase friction. Biodiesel is a wonderful lubricity agent. It's meant to enhance the longevity of the engine. So from that respect, it's quite a good product. Interestingly enough, for older cars that begin using, where a consumer will use biodiesel, where they have been using regular diesel over a period of years, there is, because it is such a clean fuel, you may have to retrofit the hoses in your engine because the old hoses will ultimately be eaten through by this fuel. And you also have to worry about the engine filter because it takes all the gunk that has built up over the years and cleans it out of the fuel lines. But a newer car is made to adapt to that and needs no retrofitting whatsoever.
Okay. And longer life as far as the engine itself is concerned.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, that is correct. We're currently working on a project where they've identified some significant savings, and I don't have dollar amounts in front of me, but in terms of truckers who are running on diesel, where even the premium that's associated with biodiesel can actually benefit them in the long term in terms of ongoing maintenance.
That's truckers and commercial operations that I was, thinking of, the average non-commercial vehicle would probably take a long time one way or the other to make any significant difference.
Mm-hmm.
What about things like engines like on trains, bigger engines than we would...
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I am not aware of the practical application for a biofuel with respect to an engine of that size. One of my colleagues may know something that I don't, but I have not come across any material regarding case studies on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Glenn, tell me, on the tax credit that you mentioned on a 1 cent per percent of biofuel, is that coming from our economic development department, from funds there, or?
Mr. Chair, that's actually a federal tax credit. And that would be specific to biodiesel. Ethanol has a separate tax credit associated with it that is 51 cents per gallon.
Separate from the biodiesel?
Separate from biodiesel, yes.
And that's a tax credit?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Any other questions?
No questions.
Representative Lynn.
Glenn, thank you very much. And do you know where we are, the usage of alternative fuels compared to other states? Are we in line with other states? Are we advancing compared to other states? Where we are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lynn, that's a wonderful question that I don't have an answer to. In terms of per capita usage of biofuels, I can only say from my own anecdotal evidence and experience that we tend to be on the forefront in terms of our usage of flex fuel vehicles, alternative fuel vehicles, such as hybrids. We are, I think, per capita 5 times greater in terms of our hybrid usage than any other state. But with respect to biodiesel, it's still a very small percentage. I would say that we are also leading the pack in many ways. I know that because I have a biodiesel vehicle that I purchased, and it is a 2004 Jetta Wagon TDI, and they are few and far between. If you go to a dealership, you will find one, if that, on the lot, because they are gone as quickly as they can get them in.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. How about the R&D research center? Do we have any research in our state, or what, do we get the research from the other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, that is an area that we could use some improvement. We do have the research going on. Oregon State University and others are doing some biomass and biofuel-related research. As I was speaking with one of my colleagues, Brent Searle, who you'll hear from later, we agree that there are opportunities out there that we've not been able to take advantage of simply because we don't have the resources to stay on top of those. And we would like to be able to provide the expertise and staffing resources not only to the universities but also to private industry to do some collaboration and put together some proposals that can earn us some federal dollars. If memory serves, in a recent award of the SBIR program, we had absolutely no awards, and I believe we may have had two applicants, which was two more than I think we had the year before. The majority of the awards are going to Midwestern states, that where biofuels has been a larger component of their industry, and that's largely due to the markets that they have and the agricultural base that they have.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Excellent information.
Thank you.
I would like at some time in the future, not along the lines of your expertise, but to know maybe how the manufacturers are looking at this whole industry in terms of retrofitting and some of those issues. But we really appreciate the information you brought to us. Brent Searle.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brent Searle with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I wanted to share with you a little bit from the department's perspective in the ag industry on biofuel development in the state and opportunities there. Again, building on some things that have already been covered, and I'll go through them fairly quickly, but grower interest in biofuels and renewable fuels has gone up dramatically in the last couple of years, and there's many reasons for that. One, the 2002 Farm Bill, for the first time in history, had an energy title contained in the Farm Bill with incentives for growers and grower cooperatives. So some of these incentives are through that mechanism. There's various grants, both for growers and for processors, and we've been working with entities trying to access those. There's also, as was mentioned, the 2004 Jobs Bill that was signed into law continues the tax exemption for ethanol and extended that to biodiesel for the first time. It's a two-year window there. It expires at the end of 2006, so that's something we'll have to work with our congressional interest in extending beyond 2006 so that there's that continuation of tax exemption on the federal fuel tax for biodiesel as well. That's one of the things that has really spurred ethanol production nationwide is that excise tax exemption. And Glenn also mentioned the U.S. EPA mandate for low sulfur diesel that will be phased in starting in 2006 for on-road vehicles and later for off-road vehicles. And that also is going to lend to the market pull demand for biodiesel as a lubricity replacement for sulfur in diesel fuel. So all of these things at the national level, the prices of petroleum products, and some technological changes have really changed the dynamics in the biofuels and are making it more economically viable right now than it has, I think, been at any time really in the history of our country. Speaking briefly about biodiesel, we're largely, for Oregon, this is really the opportunity here for our crop base is biodiesel more than ethanol. And we're talking about a crop called canola, rapeseed, closely associated with that. One's high in uric acid, one's low in uric acid, which means the low uric acid is the food grade that's generally used for cooking, but is also the preferred for biodiesel because the byproduct, the meal that's left over after they extract the oil, is very palatable, usable for livestock feed. The high uric acid rapeseed is more of an industrial product, biolubricants and other things. Mustard seed is also a possibility. But again, the mill that's left, livestock don't particularly like the mustard taste in that. So we'll probably see more emphasis on canola, because the economics in building one of these facilities really relies on the byproducts as well as just the oil processing. And so that cattle livestock feed that is byproduct is a critical part of the development of these facilities. Most of the production is likely going to be in eastern Oregon as a rotational crop with wheat, dryland wheat production. It's been grown there. We know it will grow. The part of the challenge to date has been there hasn't been a local market for it, and there is no crushing facility in the Northwest. It either has to be shipped to Canada or North Dakota to get crushed. So transportation cost on that has just made it uneconomical for growers here to use it as a viable rotation crop to date. So it's kind of been this chicken-egg problem where we don't have facilities in our state, but the processors, those investors who build those facilities, want a committed production capacity on the feedstock before, you know, they want to move on a plant. So it's a challenge to get beyond that dilemma. But I think we are getting there, and you've heard about a few of those projects. There's really a couple stages in the process. The growing of the crop in itself is the, you know, varietal development, research in rotations, and low cultivation, no-till seeding, all these kinds of things OSU is working on. That's one phase of it. Once you harvest, you've got a crushing extraction process, and that requires a press to do that. Those facilities at present don't exist. Again, plans in the works. And then you've got to move the oil to a processing facility and actually go through the process of converting it to the biodiesel, which can be blended with regular diesel products. There are, in some stage, about 8 projects in Oregon in biodiesel production. Some of these on the smaller end are actually going to be using waste grease, we call yellow grease, from restaurants, other facilities, food processing that have that use different types of vegetable greases or animal-based greases, and then can process that into biodiesel afterwards. And on the from there in crop production, there's proposals on the table anywhere from 1 million to 75 million gallons in biodiesel production. This, if all of these come online, that's the you know, the most optimistic view of it, but it would require up to 1 million acres of crop production in canola or some other oilseed crop. In the Northwest here, that's significant. That would be a significant economic development to both our rural areas and the urban areas in terms of the other jobs and process and transportation and such involved.
And how much, what percentage of that would be of our agricultural lands?
In Oregon, eastern Oregon, there probably in the rotational use, the way wheat is cropped, because they fallow part of it and they could bring that into a production rotation with an oilseed crop, potentially 400,000 acres, somewhere in that range. In Oregon, we could see some in the valley here, but it probably wouldn't supplant grass seed in a major way or other higher value crops here. We may see anywhere from 20 to 50,000 acres in the valley. But we have other issues here to deal with. There are high-value vegetable crops grown here, seed crops, radishes, sugar beet seeds. Same family, brassica family, they'll cross-pollinate. So we have control order districts in the valley. There's a 3-mile limit between where a canola or oilseed crop can be grown in terms of where these vegetable seeds are grown. So it's a management issue here in the valley, more so than eastern Oregon.
On the cropping issue, of course, with wheat, as one of the crops are, we could alternate with between wheat and canola or, you know, mustard. Isn't there a growing tendency in eastern Oregon to not crop the alternate crop that some of the wheat fields are finding that, especially with the no-drill
mm-hmm.
Seeding process, that this may even be the desirable route to go. The number of acres of yield may be significantly greater than what we're talking about,
right.
It seems to me.
Yes. Mr. Representative Jensen, I think you're correct in that observation. It could be more than that, depending on what they find with rotational benefits. There's significant pest control benefits, soil fertility, and other things that comes from crop rotation. So,
I believe there's an interesting experiment plot at the facility out of Pendleton where they have been, not rotating, but wheat has been the native crop on that since, like, now back to the 1930s, if I'm remembering correctly. And in recent years, the things that they've found is that production is going up now on this test plot, that wheat is basically a native crop
mm-hmm.
to the lands of eastern Oregon, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of on the verge of revolutionizing maybe our thinking about that, and this is not a crop. I think we have significantly more potential, and of course, in addition to that, we've had the advent of the CRP programs too, which mm-hmm. in many cases we've taken some cropland out of production for use in the CRP program, that if we could use the land to compete with the Near East for fuel, might find its way back into production too.
Yeah, Mr. Representative, that's a good point. The many of the CRP contracts are actually coming up for expiration, and they're being more targeted about how they renew those, and there may be opportunity to bring some of that cropland back into production with rotational oilseed crops and such. So, good point.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Miller.
Excuse the city girl's question, if you will. Is there an issue with regard to the water demand for these crops in some of the areas that you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, most of the production in eastern Oregon would be on dry land wheat acreage, so they don't irrigate that presently. So there are varieties of canola that are more drought tolerant than others and things, so I'm sure they'll be doing more variety development and adaptation such to increase yields for the region, but by and large, it will be non-irrigated. And depending on, what supply and demand does and prices, some of them may go to irrigated acres. They can certainly increase the yields substantially with irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
But again, here in the valley, by and large, grass seed production is non-irrigated. There are some who irrigate, but probably, 80% is non-irrigated.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it would... Most of it would not involve irrigation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, if you'll indulge me. Can you give us some sense as to the effect of this low-sulfur diesel requirement on the use of biodiesel for lubricity purposes? I mean, are we talking about replacing half of the petroleum diesel or 5% of it or what in order to provide the lubricity that you now get from sulfur?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnard, my understanding is that a 2% blend replaces the current level of lubricity in in regular petroleum diesel with the sulfur removed. It actually, at that level, even adds more lubricity than has been with taken out from the sulfur. So that's the level that most of the proposals and discussions you'll see about trying to, you know, phase in biodiesel blends is at a 2% level, because it meets that lubricity issue there.
And so following up on that question, that's a very substantial increase on the current production of biodiesel, isn't it, nationwide?
Yes, the nationwide it would be. It's not a requirement nationwide.
No.
It's being looked at kind of on a state-by-state basis. And here in Oregon, I think that would amount to about 15 million gallons or somewhere in that neighborhood for a 2% blend in all diesel fuel. If I help me with, is that close?
Yeah. And to get back to my question, how does that compare against actual production now?
In-state?
Yes.
Mr. Representative Barnhart, we have no in-state production right now. So,
but we're importing biodiesel.
Right, we're importing... Yeah, 9.5 gallons. So this would be a tenfold increase.
So we're looking in just a short while at 10 times the amount we're using now. And I take it if we continue at the production level we are now, we'd be importing all of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, in the short term, that may be the case, although some of these projects could be online within a year. And again, initially, they may be importing their feedstock because we won't have significant production, feedstock production. But within 3 years, we could have several million gallon facilities online here in Oregon.
Okay. And I want to switch topics, if I may. Thank you. You indicated that one of the problems is sort of almost a chicken and egg problem of for getting the pressures. Mm-hmm. The industrial infrastructure necessary to process these seed plants for biodiesel. What are we talking about in terms of investment? What's the amount needed to get this sort of thing going?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it of course is scalable to the size of facility, and the numbers that I've seen for the crushing part of it isn't really the intensive capital part of it. The screw press, for $1 million, you can get a screw press for a 4 or 5 million gallon facility, so multiply that up by the gallons you're working with. But it's the land, it's the building you have to put it on, it's the storage facilities. If you're running these year-round, you've got to have seed storage. And then the actual processing facility itself is really the costly factor here. So it is capital intensive. There are some growers that have been talking about creating a co-op to actually buy a screw press so they could at least have that piece of it and entice some processors here. But I think we're seeing enough interest because of all these things we've talked about, the incentives and other things, that the investment community are seriously committing dollars towards these facilities. So I think that dilemma will soon be broken here in the next year or two. We'll see capital coming in to build facilities.
Thank you.
That's
the kind of prediction I was hoping you were going to give
yeah.
us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I didn't hear a figure, though, of these three facilities. Is there a general figure what they would need to invest to build a production facility?
The
10 million, 20 million, 100 million?
Well, the big one, the 75 million gallon facility, I think they're talking well over $100 million investment for their operation. I think in a 50 million size facility, we're probably talking $25 to $30 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that would serve the whole region, Washington, Oregon, Idaho. Or just Oregon?
If this larger facility comes to fruition, they could well use, you know, over 500,000 acres for that facility alone in production. So that would be a regional effort to supply that, yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Cool. Representative Jensen.
Well, it just strikes me that sure, it's probably going to be capital intensive. But, and regardless of, you know, what it's a matter of the balance of the equation between how much a barrel oil is costing us versus how much a barrel the biodiesel or bio is going to be costing us. And as the price of oil in the Near East, you know, goes beyond $50 a barrel, we'll find this to be much more economical than we find it today. If something happens and it goes to $30 a barrel, there won't be anybody talking about biodiesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, just an observation on that point. Vice President of ExxonMobil, I saw just the other day, indicated that the production of oil, world oil, has essentially peaked and is declining 4 to 6% per year, and with the onset of demand in China and some of the other developing countries, it'll be very tough to bring additional petroleum production online to meet just the present demand and growth demand. So that's a significant issue that I think for those interested in biofuels is good news in a sense. Also, some recent studies by EPA looking at the life cycle cost of fuels indicate that biodiesel, for every dollar of cost fuel that goes into that to produce it, you get it's over three. I think it's 3.2-to-1 ratio of energy out for energy put in, compared to petroleum fuels that are less than one. When you consider the cost of transportation, everything to bringing it to the United States, so the economics are certainly there today more than they've been in previous years.
This is a follow-up on that series of questions. I'm assuming that there's some wonks out there who have already figured out what the dollar per barrel equivalent of oil is that we have to have before biodiesel starts to be economically, before it starts to pencil, if I can use a real estate term, so that it makes sense for people to be in that business. Just from an economic point of view, forgetting about the other things that governments are working on to encourage people to do it. Do you have any? Do you know what that is? I mean, is it $50 a barrel, $75 a barrel, $43 a barrel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byron, I don't know what the magic number is there, but I think we're close.
We're close now.
I would say we are. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing the amount of interest that's developing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And California is a huge market to our south, and I think that's, you know, Oregon is a key location for our port, coastal exports down both up and down the coast, and so why we're seeing very large ethanol and biodiesel facilities being proposed in the Portland area. It's a key location, and there's some big dollars being talked about here.
Yes. Well, I just have a comment on this. I was a comment on your comment. I agree completely. I think the fact that Oregon, where it's located, the fact that we have a large agricultural land base, that we have a capacity to grow a large percentage of our own food if we need to, that with the increased cost of transportation, which are going to be upon us probably a lot faster than any of us would like to be the case, simply because of the reduction in availability of fossil fuels, Oregon, from the standpoint of comparative economics, may be in a pretty good position compared to many other places in the world, and we need to be prepared to take advantage of that.
Representative Jensen.
It just strikes me, Mr. Chair, that this may be a great boom to the Atkinson diet when The price of all these carbohydrates become too expensive to be used for food, and we're going to be using them for
getting around
petroleum or diesel fuel instead.
I'm afraid you were going to pursue the idea of squeezing me down and getting oil or grease or something. Thank you very much, Brent. Appreciate that. We have understand that one of our other committees, the Ways and Means on Transportation and Business Development, has been talking about biodiesel, and the tapes are available to for any of the committee here to kind of brief up on them. But our next presentation is on a different type of fuel processing. So I'll call the team up on clean fossil fuel. Kind of working alongside biodiesel.
Mr. Chair, may we ask for about a 2 or 3 minute recess so we can arrange for the PowerPoint presentation and so forth?
That's right. Your objection.
Thank you. And where is that?
I'll follow you.
It's straight across.
Mr. Chairman,
send a light.
Thank you.
I've got a light here. I can almost read this.
Ready, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for allowing us to present.
Would you each give your name and your relationship to the company?
Yes, sir. I certainly will. My name is Rick Holt. I'm Executive Vice President of Government Relations for Fuel Max LLC. I would like to introduce, first of all, thank you all for having us here. I'd like to introduce you to Fuel Max, an ultra clean fuel treatment. May I introduce our partners in this program? Dr. William Kirko, Project Development. Stan Shaw, Project Development. Michael Marks, to my right here, who is LLC for Fuel Max. Dan Lovelady, General Manager of Pacific Corp Railroad. And we have with us Mr. Ken Karishabadi, who is a former Union 76 Dealer Counsel for the Northwest Gasoline Dealer Association. At this time, I would like to turn this over to Mr. Marks, and we'll proceed with the presentation, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to present before you this afternoon. We've accumulated a lot of information in a very short amount of time, and we'll do the best that we can to organize this and present our product before you efficiently this afternoon. And I really would like to thank the presenters that have come before us. I listened intently to Mr. Graney, Montgomery, and Mr. Searley, and I think they provided us with a lot of very valuable information that we can use in terms of explaining how our product can be responsive to the needs in Oregon. Perhaps to be a little more efficient, we've prepared a PowerPoint presentation. If nothing else, it's probably a little more fun to listen to me go on about this, so let me proceed with that, please. The first is a news story that was broadcast on KTVL Channel 10 News here in Oregon, and I'd like to show you that news story. And I'm sure if we put our fuel additive into my laptop, it would operate a little more efficiently as this loads.
Cars are the largest single source of pollution in the United States. If you drive them, EPA officials say you're responsible for more than 12,000 pounds of pollutants a year.
When fuels are burned, they're never burned fully. And the emissions are related back to volatile hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, and really particulate are the major ones.
Since the 1970s, typical vehicle emissions have dropped, but the miles we drive have more than doubled, and pollution is more problematic than ever before.
The situation has gotten bad, especially in some very major cities.
Even in southern Oregon, Jones says the high elevation, coupled with the bowl-shaped valley, traps pollutants.
Whatever pollutants are released over what city, they don't get mixed away and downstream. They get stuck or held within that city's environment.
What if there was a way to clean your engine, clear the air, and ultimately help the environment for years to come? One company says they have the answer.
Science is changing. What we have done is we have broken their sets of laws and actually come into something that's very toxic.
Kirko says if all drivers use this additive in Los Angeles, for example, that city smog would be cleared out in 45 days.
We want it in all of the fuels all over the world. For the reason of the clean air, the reduction of cost of fuel, and we would not have the situations we have now with depending on oil from other countries.
The additive is ethanol-based with what Kirko calls a special catalyst. When the combination is added to any fuel type, gasoline, diesel, bunker fuel, he says it produces a complete burn.
When you have a complete combustible burn, you have eliminated the emissions. And consequently, you're burning all of the fuel in the engine. And when all the fuel is burned, then you're having a greater economy factor, more power, and less emissions.
Kirko says the additive would help solve global warming, ozone, and pollution-related health problems.
We can put special devices inside of smokestacks for industry and burn our product in the smokestack and eliminate the emissions coming out of smokestacks.
What kinds of problems have we had so far in promoting this?
The greatest problem we've had is that nobody believes it. It seems too unbelievable, too good to be true.
Too good to be true or true to the test? We tried it out in our own car and calculated the results over a month's time. Meanwhile, talking to people who've used it as well.
Running lousy. It wouldn't stay running. I added the additive to it, and it started, clearing up, and it's been running fine since.
Still skeptical? So are we.
As anybody, I was skeptical at first.
Fire Chief Kyle Kirshner tried out Nestio, hoping to reduce emissions in the station garage.
Mainly, I was concerned about the benefits of the smoke in the bay and the environment for our employees.
Without the product, the exhaust pipe lets out pollutants, which he says are a health risk.
When we would start this engine in the bay, it would literally fill the upper portion of the bay up with blue smoke. And after we put the product in, it reduced it significantly to where there's very, very little, if any, smoke.
We wanted to find out for ourselves how well Nestio works, so we put the product to the test.
You're testing it here at the station. You'll have the proof. In New Jersey, we reduced the emissions from 758 parts per million to one part per million. Nobody in this country has a product that can do that.
Each time I fill up the tank, I put the right amount of Nestio, one part additive, for 40 parts of gasoline. When the Department of Environmental Quality tests emissions, they're looking for the biggest pollution culprit, hydrocarbon. For the product, the EQ tests show our car emitted 80 parts per million in low idle. In high idle, the car emitted 60 parts per million.
Anytime it's a double-digit number or below 0.5, it's good.
After 7 tanks of gas with the additive, the hydrocarbons dropped significantly, and the gas mileage increased by more than 20%. But even after seeing the results, some are still skeptical. But Kirko says the company has tested it in labs and has spent $3 million doing so.
I'm very confident this is going to make it. I know it's going to make it. Because we have the proof.
The Fuel Science Institute tested it, as well as the Federal Agency for Testing, the FTP, the Department of Energy, and even an Army base in Utah. In all those tests, Kirko says the product with all its promises.
In the very first test we ran, we put it in a blazer. The opacity readings were 32, and the next day they were down to 16. and they had continually gone through over the course of the next week. They replaced about three filters, which is really interesting because it's doing a clean cleansing effect in the tank.
University studies, FTP test, jet engine test, truck test, and we think it's time now because of the condition of the earth and the atmosphere, because of the price of fuel. We can literally save the oil companies millions of barrels of fuel every month by using our power.
Well, thank you for watching that news story. It does sound quite incredible, and I think that in order to understand a little bit about our product that we're presenting today, that we need to change our approach to understand what we're trying to accomplish. The other fuel additives are accomplishing emission reductions, there's no question about it. However, we're aiming to accomplish much greater emission reductions and also increase fuel economy, which is a unique addition to the formulation that you'll have to calculate. So just let me go through this introduction for you, which touches on the major points that I'd like to present. First, before I start, I just want to make something clear. You've heard about this product under different names, whether it be Nest Fuel or Fuel Enhancer in some of the handouts that you receive. And as we'll explain shortly, I'd just like to explain that during the time, this started out being developed by Fuel Science Institute, by Clean Fossil Fuels, and by Nest Fuels Incorporated. And these independent companies that were working on this have now consolidated themselves under FuelMax Incorporated, I believe as of approximately November of last year. So some of the materials that you have may have different names on it, but be assured that we're talking about the same product, which is now held by FuelMax LLC. So with that, let me proceed to our introduction. We're here in a hope to address Oregon's energy needs and your clean air and pollution situation, and we're trying to work on that with you. And I'd like to explain that the ultra-clean fuel treatment is a fuel additive that acts as a catalyst, and it helps absorb and harness much of the unused power that's produced by the combustion of fossil fuels and gasoline and diesel engines. And I want to be clear about that. We're talking about gasoline and diesel engines, where, for example, ethanol may be suitable for gasoline engines. It really doesn't address the issue of diesel engines, and this product does that. As has been explained, with more efficient combustion and the application of fuel's potential energy by capturing it, absorbing it, and harnessing it into the engine's power, this provides significant increases in fuel economy and, since it's burning the fuel more efficiently, even greater reductions in the harmful emissions. And I'd like to say that with UCFT in the tank, the citizens of Oregon can enjoy lower energy costs and less pollution. I'd like to repeat that. Lower energy costs and less pollution. Based on UCFT's extraordinary performance and test results up until this time, UCFT has demonstrated to us its ability to qualify for the Ultra Clean Fuel Classification from the EPA. And therefore, at this time, FuelMax LLC is proceeding with its application to the EPA for certification as an ultra-clean fuel product. Now, FuelMax is now negotiating with several EPA and CARB-recognized laboratories to perform the official test regimen required to accompany our application process that's now in progress. It's also important to note that UCFT is made from renewable resources and is biodegradable. UCFT can presently be produced with existing materials made around the country, and we can make it in sufficient quantity to treat the entire fuel requirement of the state of Oregon at this time. But probably after listening to my previous presenters, An important issue to consider is that UCFT could eventually be produced entirely in Oregon. UCFT production in Oregon would then consume raw materials, byproducts, scrap materials, and other materials created by the biofuel industry and created by Oregon's own lumber and other related industries. This is exactly what the other presenters were talking about. And I'm here to present to you today that subject to positive environmental and economic impact and feasibility reports, FuelMax LLC is prepared to commit the necessary resources to build abandoned industrial facilities and other new facilities into ethanol and or IPA production facilities. And I add isopropyl alcohol because I need to reiterate that the ethanol side of the additive works fine for gasoline, but in order to work in diesel fuels, you have to mix the, our catalyst additive with isopropyl alcohol, which could be made from the same products as the ethanol is made. Now, I would hope that Oregon now would consider the choice of UCFT as an important opportunity for producing cleaner and less expensive fuels, clean industrial growth, increased tax revenues, lower unemployment, and many other benefits that were even brought to my attention today by listening to the previous presentations. Now, it's important that you know that we have the ability to follow through with our proposals. Clearly, this is a very important question. My previous presenters, Mr. I think his name is Mr. Serrell. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the fellow, but I was listening to his presentation carefully. Was predicting the influx of investment interest into this economy. Well, folks, here we are, and that's why we're making this presentation to you today. We can follow through with our proposals in Oregon because we're backed by the Wall Street firm of D.H. Blair Investment Banking Corporation. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about our backers. D.H. Blair is a New York City-based full-service investment bank and private equity firm that's been in business for quite a while, as you can see. Over the years, Blair has become recognized as a leader. They identify emerging growth companies and bring out their potential to become significant businesses. Through capital markets, Blair brings such emerging companies together with funds that companies like ourselves need to pursue those opportunities and successfully succeed at our proposals. In the past and over the history, Blair has raised over $3 billion in support of over 400 emerging growth companies in this country. And I'm not going to read all the names to you, but you'll find them in the handout that we provided along with this presentation. You can go through these. Some of these are the companies that D.H. Blair has brought to the public at this time. It becomes quite an impressive list, actually. Perhaps move a little faster through this list. Well, as you can see, as a result of D.H. Blair's financing efforts, they have played a critical role in many financial business developments, many startup companies, and allowing them to grow, to create new jobs, and introduce new and better products that enhance our lives and the standard of living. And now, hopefully, we can apply that to the standard of our air quality and the cost of our fuel. I'd like to introduce some of the people that are sitting here with us. Mr. Holt, I think, introduced himself previously as right now as a project director. And I don't know if I carefully introduced myself. My name is Michael Marks, and I'm the director of business operations for FuelMax LLC, and I work closely with D.H. Blair in New York. Mr. Shore is with us today, and he's also involved with inventing and developing this project from its inception. And Dr. Kirko is working also as a product developer and in marketing and bringing the information that you folks will need to the public in this matter. I'm very happy today that Dan Lovelady was able to join us. He's the general manager of the Central Oregon and Pacific Railroads. And hopefully, in a little while, he'll present to you the economic interests of the railroad in this project. And Ken has joined us also today. He's a fuel industry expert and a marketing consultant for us. Now, prior to approaching this committee today, we've certainly conducted numerous tests. Some of them have been purely anecdotal tests conducted by ourselves to assure ourselves that our product is working effectively. And we've also conducted tests at laboratories and other independent facilities. The list is quite long, and it may not be effective to go through all those tests today, although they can be provided to you. I just would like to highlight several of these tests if we could. The Ultra Clean Fuel product was tested by the military in the Department of the Army, and I think that that Ken
Rick.
Rick was present at that test, and perhaps you'd like to speak about that for a moment.
I'd love to. We had a chance to introduce this to the Army, the South Carolina National Guard, to Mr. Our Major Buzel, who's a test pilot and commander of helicopter maintenance currently serving our country in Iraq. The Major is a civilian, in civilian life is an airline pilot, and I have included, you have two packs. And I would certainly like you to look over his letter of January 25th to see what he has to say about this for not only his armed services, but for the military and those who fly commercially. It's outstanding. The test came back very positive, as you will read in the material that we have provided you. And I hope that we'll have a chance to provide you more material in the future.
What page is that on, Mr. Holt?
Sir, I did not mark the pages, but it's the letter of 25 June 05, and he has written to Dateline news story to request help in getting this into the military and commercial market to prevent aircraft from being shot down. Help preventing aircraft from being shot down. It's awesome letter.
Is there a certification at all on that from EPA or DEQ? South Carolina?
Oh, the South Carolina testing was done in compliance with national test standards, and the whole report is in that green folder that I handed out. The other folder,
Yes.
There it is. You'll find the whole test that was completed and done in South Carolina. As a result of the logistics, the improvement of logistics, the increase of fuel economy up to 47%, the enhancement of making the equipment work that wasn't working, the cleaning up of turbochargers, and also the reduction of heat. Signature from helicopter engines, the increase of power and performance for helicopter engines, increasing the logistics of the Army without a long train of supply that will be needed in wartime scenarios. It would also hide the smoke that we so often see in the war pictures over in Iraq, where the insurgents or the enemy can locate our troops by the smoke that's coming out of the trucks. And consequently, by the elimination of that smoke, they don't know where our troops are. Now, the heat signature, I think, is a very important issue because from even with Dan Lovelady at the railroad, Central Oregon Pacific Railroad, from 777 degrees Fahrenheit, heat signature went down to 184 degrees. You cannot obtain a lock-on with a missile that has a heat-seeking device. You cannot
lock on to an aircraft or to a truck or to anything that loses that much heat signature coming out of the exhaust.
I don't see the results here. Is that...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Representative Bryan.
This is a question for Rick Holt.
Yes, sir.
Right. Last time I saw you, you were a Klamath County or a Jackson County Commissioner.
Yes, sir.
And you were raising holy hell about ethanol. What's the difference here?
Well, sir, my it started out because of Mr. Karashabadi, because my car failed after using MTBE in my auto. Then I started an extensive research as to what's going wrong, what's happening in this state. Yeah, our presentation will get into explaining that, but that's how I became involved, and I live here. I breathe the same air, and found out that the MTBE was just killing us. So I took a lead in that, and then it got into other things.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I hope I answered that. Okay.
I think you did.
Yes.
Next, I was hoping that I could introduce to you Mr. Stanley Shore, who's seated behind me, although I understand Mr. Shore is a little bit under the weather today and doesn't feel comfortable presenting today. And he was present at the next test that I'd like to discuss with you very briefly from... let's see. Sorry, we're going the wrong way. I beg your pardon, I think we just went the wrong direction. So.
Maybe you want to skip the news articles.
Yeah, I'm not playing this through again.
Okay.
There we go. Mr. Shore had conducted tests at the Northrop Aircraft plant in Pico Riviera, California. And there they conducted tests to determine that diesel fuel particulates were reduced by 95% and jet fuel particulates were reduced by also by 98% as well. This information and chart is included in the handout that you have, and this is a graph of the time and particulate reductions that were measured at Northrop. Similarly, Mr. Shore also conducted tests on city buses located in Monmouth County, New Jersey. There, they tested seven buses. At the beginning of the test, the county provided these seven buses, and five of these seven buses failed their initial emissions test. They weren't able to pass their emissions test. Then after running 1 month with UCFT, additive in their fuel, all the buses were able to pass their emission test. In addition, all seven buses showed increased fuel economy by up to 18%. So not only were they getting cleaner emissions, cleaner engines, and cleaner operations, but they showed in operating diesel fuel in these buses with UCFT additive that they showed an 18% increase in fuel economy. And the significance of that is not only self-obvious, but I'll show you some additional importance to those things shortly in the presentation.
So were these run with an EPA certifier or...
I think I can answer that, but I'd like to defer to Mr. Shore to see if he can.
Would you come up and give your name? Come up and give your name for the record.
The testing was
State your name.
Stanley Shaw. The testing was conducted by Monmouth County, New Jersey, and they're certified to do their EPA testing for the state.
Have the records of those tests?
Pardon?
Could you forward the records of those tests to us, the actual test? This is a summary of the test.
Yes.
Okay.
It can be, yes.
Thank you.
Dr. Kirko, can you please make a note of that so we're sure that we do that? Okay.
We have a complete booklet. It's about this thick. We have a $3 million. When we're talking about certification, we're talking about national test standards that have been conducted since the 70s, the early 70s, by the EPA and CAR, California Air Resources Board. When we test to those standards. Now, not always do you have EPA inspectors coming out. What they will do is evaluate every test, the test data that you present, and then they will certify that as a certified test.
Excellent.
So I think at this point we should just forward to you those test results so that you can evaluate them. Finally, I'd like to discuss a test that was run here in Oregon at the Central Oregon Pacific Railroad. And before I introduce Dan Lovelady, the general manager of the Oregon Pacific Railroad, I would just like to indicate to you that we presented the editor to the railroad and last spring conducted several emission tests on the diesel engines at the railroad, and in summary of those tests, I have some charts that show you the result of the reduction in emissions, and I'd best like to go through that with you. And you can see on the left is a baseline, and the 4,000 is the diesel number. It's the engine number, and engine number 4,001 was treated with fuel, and they were run next to each other, and the results were compared. And these are the different emissions that we found.
I may, could I explain that?
Would you like to explain these?
Please do.
Thanks. Welcome back to everyone. We had a meeting with Mr. Lovelady, and he had the inspector from Texas, EPA inspectors, come in and test a product that was not ours. And I went to him and I told him we would like to compare our product to the product that was being tested in number 4,000. And the results that he got in number 4,000 were very, very low. And so consequently he said, if you can make, or your testing will improve over these results, we would be very interested. So when we tested with 4,001, that engine, we completed the testing and we compared the two from the other product that was used in 4,000 compared to what we got with 4,001. There are only one little difference is the engine size. Now these engines are 3,000 horsepower diesel engines. They're not anything small, and I would like to have Mr. Lovelady to give his result on the testing that he did.
Okay, so we're going to get to that presentation in one moment. These graphs, I don't know if you want to go through them. I don't know if the committee is interested in studying these graphs at this time or to move forward into some of the other benefits from the railroad test. These are harmful emissions and resulting, remember, our additive was in the 4001 engine. We have NOx. It was greatly reduced, as you can see. The carbon dioxide. And this particular graph shows the opacity. This would be the smoke emissions, which is extremely significant. And as you could see, by using UCFT fuel additive, the smoke was tremendously reduced. And this graph demonstrates the actual savings in fuel economy. That means that when I discuss fuel economy, simply put, that means miles per gallon. Are you getting more miles per gallon of fuel or less miles per gallon of fuel? That's what I mean when we're talking about fuel economy. And to discuss this with you, I'd like to present Dan Lovelady from the general manager of the Argonne Pacific Railroad to discuss his findings on the fuel economy and the economic interests of the railroad in this product. Mr. Lovelady.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Dan Lovelady. I'm general manager of Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad. I'd like to start out by telling you a little bit about us. We're one of 19 short line railroads in Oregon. We have 439 miles of railroad. We run from Weed, California to Eugene, Oregon, and from Eugene, Oregon down the coast to Coquille. We serve 75 customers at more than 100 locations. We have 27 locomotives, 112 employees, and we interchange with the Union Pacific Railroad in both Eugene, Oregon, and Weed, California. And our plan in 2005 is to handle about 52,000 revenue carloads, and this equates to about 160,000 truckloads that aren't on Oregon's local roads and highways. Well, we provide service to some of Southern Oregon's larger employers, Weyerhaeuser, Roseburg Forest Products, Georgia Pacific, Timber Products. Needless to say, we're very important to the economy in Southern Oregon. Diesel fuel is...
Lovelady, we're going to be under a little time pressure.
Okay.
You're pretty quick, so if you could go through the testing, that would be...
I will. Diesel fuel is a huge part of our expense. In 2005, we're going to average a use of about 185,000 gallons a month. Our fuel cost in 2005 is going to be about $3 million. We've used a fuel additive for years, primarily for reduction of fire danger to reduce the carbon particulates that are emitted out through the stack. And I've always been skeptical of the fuel additives. In fact, when Rick called me, I call it snake oil. So in early 2004, I agreed to conduct two tests on two different fuel additives. One was environmental fuels, and one was at that time called clean fossil fuels, now called Fuel Max. Both tests, we had positive results. With the clean fossil fuel tests, what we did was we put the locomotive on a testing machine for 2 hours at full throttle in notch 8. Then we put the product in the locomotive. We ran it for several months. Then we brought it in, and we performed the same test again with the same locomotive. And the results were really exciting to me for two reasons. One, the fuel savings, and secondly, the reduction of the carbon particulates. Prior to using the additive, our fuel usage was 3.54 gallons per minute. After using the additive, the usage was 3.04 gallons per minute. So we saved nearly 0.5 gallon fuel per minute. And with 27 locomotives running almost full time around the clock, I estimate our fuel cost savings to be nearly $200,000 a year by using the additive. A bonus was the reduction in carbon particulates emitted because of the fire danger, and we were very pleased with that, along with the reduced smoke and smell emissions. Even though we're not regulated in Oregon, the new locomotive regulations in California were just implemented, and I think that very soon other states will follow, so that's a real bonus there.
And based on the testing we did, I think this is a worthwhile product, and would be of great benefit to pursue it for other uses and other applications in Oregon. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lovelady. I just want to summarize that. I believe that the savings, fuel savings, amounted to approximately 16%, and if you can remember that figure, it will be significant a little later on in the presentation. I don't want to go through at this time other successful tests that we've conducted. They're in your package, and if you have any questions about them, we'll surely be happy to address them. Fuel treated with UCFT have consistently measured impressive improvements in fuel economy, reduction of harmful emissions, and cleaner engine parts requiring less maintenance. These spectacular benefits have been consistently repeated in a wide variety of different vehicles, engine types, and fuels. As I mentioned during the introduction, we're now commencing its rigorous test regimen to be certified by the EPA as an ultra-clean fuel product. Dr. Kirko, at some time, if you want, can answer questions about the many federal programs that offer grant money to states that have implemented ultra-clean fuel products in their state. I think that some of the previous presenters who work with you here in the Capitol are familiar with those grants and would be very interested to hear when we're certified as an ultra-clean fuel product. To summarize the product benefits, I'd like to say that the ultra-clean fuel treatment is registered with the Environmental Protection Agency as a fuel additive. You can look it up under reference number 1895-001 as fuel catalyst. Ultra-clean fuel treatment is biodegradable. It's renewable. And right now it seems to be very important here that it's sustainable, which means that we can treat the requirements for the entire state. Testing of fuel economy improvements vary between 15% and 50%. That depends upon the vehicle, the engine type, the base fuel being used, and the circumstances of its treatment. And UCFT effectively cleans carbon deposits from engine parts and reduces maintenance, of course. It keeps the fuel injectors, oxygen sensors, and other automotive and engine parts clean, and again, it produces requires less maintenance. Now, we'd like to take a moment to compare.
Mr. Marks, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut off. I wonder if we could just.
Can I summarize one more point to you, sir? Which is, I'd like to discuss the relationship between UCFT and ethanol and biodiesel, which have been presented to the committee somewhat earlier. We don't compete with ethanol and biodiesel. We actually make them operate better. Our additive mixes with ethanol for use in gasoline, or with isopropyl alcohol to mix with either gasoline or diesel fuel. Our mixture is approximately 40 to 1. All three of these additives have a gross cost overhead. It costs money to put additive in the fuel. If you want clean air, you're going to have to put an additive in the fuel. And our cost overhead, our gross cost overhead, is competitive with the additive of ethanol or biodiesel, say approximately 12.5%. But I want to bring to this committee's attention one very, very important distinction, which is that biodiesel does not indicate any significant change in fuel economy. And ethanol does. It indicates a reduction in fuel economy. By adding ethanol to fuel, you get less miles per gallon. By adding UCFT into the fuel, we are indicating an increase in fuel economy. So, for example, if it costs 12.5% to treat the fuel with UCFT, and then in diesel, for example, showing between a 15 and 25% fuel efficiency increase, the net fuel cost has just gone down by 3%, 12%, 15%, up to 23% in diesel, and even greater amounts in gasoline. So the cost of the additive are completely mitigated, and the consumer and the government agencies are actually experiencing fuel cost savings by using this additive. So you're getting fewer emissions, less pollution, and you're saving money at the same time. It's not costing the consumer more money for the fuel. That means that diesel truck operators are able to deliver their products to the market cheaper. Oil prices will conduct themselves accordingly.
Thank you. We are going to have to cut off. We have another committee coming in 5 minutes ago.
And I'd just like to reiterate our commitment to make this product here in Oregon.
Thank you for bringing all of the information that you have. We'll look that over and be in contact with you. And I do appreciate you bringing the information to us.
Mr. Chairman, we want to thank you. And if I could close with this, we don't make ethanol, we don't make MCD, we don't make biodiesel, but we make them all better.
Great.
We're showing over 90% reduction in emissions. That's a big number, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commander.
We're adjourned.